AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
By 1986, the world knew Bill Gates' name. The sprat from Seattle who formerly wrote law in a fine room over pizza boxes was now a billionaire. On paper, at least, Microsoft's IPO had just made history. The company had gone from a sprinkle of coders to hundreds of workers, with services sprawling across Bellevue. Journalists started calling him the Boy Wonder Software. Investors hailed him as the future of business. But then's the thing. Gates didn't watch about the markers. He still lived like a pupil. His office was cluttered with law printouts, empty soda pop barrels, and a resting bag for late coding sessions. Wealth hadn't changed him important. It just gave him more coffers to chase bigger pretensions. And his biggest thing at that point was simple make Windows the global standard. The promise of Windows MS. DOS had made Microsoft rich, but it was an erected for the future. The command line system was effective, sure, but bogarting. Ordinary people didn't want to study textbook commands. They wanted commodity visual, intuitive, mortal. Gates had seen this times before when Apple released the Macintosh in 1984. The Mac's graphical stoner interface. The idea of clicking icons, dragging lines, and using a mouse changed everything. It wasn't just a computer presently. It was a tool anyone could use. Gates honored that, indeed respected it, but he was about to let Apple enjoy the conception. So he doubled down on his own interpretation, Windows. The idea was to make a graphical interface that ran on top of MS-DOS, compatible with Bing PCs. It would look like Apple's GUI, but be cheaper, open, and flexible. Gates' genius was not just specialized, it was strategic. He knew tackle companies wanted software they could certify freely, not an unrestricted system like Apple's. Windows 1.0 launched in 1985. It was a mega hit. Critics mocked it as slow and cumbrous. Pundits called it Windows 1.0. But Gates didn't blench. He told his platoon, "It'll take time. Version 3 will be the bone that sticks." He was right. Windows 3.0. Released in 1990, would come one of the most successful pieces of software ever made. That tolerance, the amenability to endure mockery while perfecting a long-term vision, came a defining Gates particularity. The Microsoft machine as Windows evolved, so did Microsoft's internal machine. Gates turned the company into commodity, like a military academe for programmers. It was a place where the smartest minds in software came to prove themselves. He held brutal product reviews where masterminds presented their work directly to him. However, he'd lean back, study, if he saw excrescence. He was then trying to be cruel. He was dropping ideas through battle. Those meetings were fabulous. Part interrogation, part masterclass. Some left in gashes. Others left inspired. But if you survived at Microsoft, you came out stronger. The stylish masterminds learned to anticipate his questions, suppose deeper, and prepare for every script. Gates had erected not just software, but a culture of high performance that awarded speed, perfection, and conviction. By the late 80s, Microsoft had grown into a global operation. Its services buzzed with inventors writing law for every major PC manufacturer. The company's profit soared, and its software was far and wide. Windows, Word, Excel, and latterly PowerPoint came the backbone of ultra-modern business. Still, Gates was not celebrating. He was paranoid, not irrationally, strategically. He believed that complacency was death. At meetings, he'd tell his platoon, "Nearly out, there's a sprat in the garage who's going to take us down if we do and keep perfecting." That mindset, part fear, part energy, kept Microsoft empty. Partnership and rivalry with Apple in the tech world. Fellowship no way stays simple. Gates and Steve Jobs had known each other for times. In the early days, Microsoft had actually written software for Macintosh, including Word and Excel. Gates admired Jobs' design sensibility. Jobs respected Gates' intellect, though he frequently set up him boring. But by the late 1980s, the fellowship had turned into contest. Apple indicted Microsoft of copying the Macintosh interface for Windows. Gates argued that visual interfaces had was before Apple, that Microsoft had stolen ideas, just evolved them. Behind the scenes, the two men battered intimately and intimately, trading brickbats and philosophical differences. Jobs was about art and stoner experience. Gates was about mileage and ubiquity. Jobs wanted to make the perfect product. Gates wanted to make the dominant bone. And dominance he achieved as IBM-compatible PCs swamped the request, all running Windows and MS-DOS. Apple's request share shrank. By the early 1990s, Microsoft controlled over 90 of the world's PC software. Gates had done it. He'd turned Microsoft into the most important company in the computer age, a life erected on law and computation outside of work. Gates' particular life remained disciplined and kindly quiet. He was dating Melinda French, a youthful product director at Microsoft who participated as intellect and practicality. Their relationship grew sluggishly, erected on collective respect and participated purpose. Musketeers described Gates during this time as both fascinating and emotionally guarded. He could shift from deep conversations about global economics to jokes about software bugs in the same discussion. He wasn't detached, just concentrated. His life was defined by systems, data, and optimization. He approached connections like he approached business, logically. When deciding whether to marry Melinda, he reportedly made a pros and cons list on a whiteboard. That's classic Gates. Indeed, particular choices ran through his logical frame. Yet, for all his computation, there was sincerity in his vision. He believed technology could make life more, that connecting people through computers would expand knowledge, productivity, and occasion. That belief was Zent Marketing. It was his core gospel. Windows 3.0, the advance, also came the moment that truly changed everything. In May 1990, Microsoft released Windows 3.0. This interpretation was briskly more stable and visually polished. It supported advanced plates, multitasking, and further memory. For the first time, using a PC felt natural. Consumers loved it. Businesses espoused it en masse. Within a time, deals surpassed every anticipation. Millions of people around the world were suddenly living in the Windows terrain, clicking, dragging, codify, and saving lines in ways that would define calculating for decades. Gates' vision had materialized. The particular computer revolution was no longer just for suckers or masterminds, it was for everyone. The success of Windows 3.0 marked a turning point not just for Microsoft, but for society. Services, seminaries, and homes came digital. Information was no longer trapped in paper. It lived inside defenses. Gates, at 35, had formally changed the world formally, and he was only getting started. The man behind the curtain, with global fame, came scrutiny. The media portrayed Gates as a blend of genius and control freak. Some saw him as a visionary, others as a monopolist in the timber. He didn't particularly watch. What he did watch about was staying ahead. At Microsoft, he came less involved in diurnal coding and further in strategy. He spent hours reading reports, assaying challengers, and conniving the company's coming move. His brain no way really shut off. He formally told Intelligencer, "If you suppose of everything as a system, you can ameliorate it. You just have to understand how the corridor fit together." That judgment added up his approach to life, not just software, but everything. He understood people, requests, and technology as interlocking factors of a massive mortal machine, and he intended to write its law. The early 90s and the internet dawn as the 1990s began, Microsoft was sitting atop the world. Gates' wealth was growing by billions. He appeared on magazine covers, gave keynote speeches, and came the face of the digital revolution. But he also tasted the wind shifting. Commodity new was coming commodity, indeed bigger than particular computers, the internet. At first, Microsoft undervalued it. Gates saw it as intriguing but not essential. But by 1993, he realized his mistake. The web was an aside design. It was a coming platform, and it would reshape everything from communication to commerce. This consummation would spark one of the most aggressive strategic pivots in Microsoft's history, but that's a story for latterly. For now, Gates was still in rich and conglomerate he'd erected. Heritage in stir by 1993, Microsoft had over 15,000 workers and billions in periodic profit. The company's lot in Redmond had grown into a small megacity. Inventors from around the world wanted to work there. It was a proving ground for gift, invention, and ambition. Inside those glass-walled services, Gates' influence was far and wide, from the lower views to the cafeteria exchanges. People quoted his expressions, followed his illustration, and internalized his drive. He'd done what many in history ever managed. He'd erected a system so important that it came unnoticeable, woven into everyday life. And yet, Gates was restless. Power in no way satisfied him for long. He was formally allowing about the coming problem, the coming dislocation, the coming way to make the machine run briskly. The boy who formerly addressed Academy computers to learn their limits was now doing the same thing, only on a global scale. By 1993, Bill Gates had erected further than a company. He'd erected an ecosystem. Microsoft wasn't just dealing software. It was defining how the world interacted with technology. Every keystroke, every document, every spreadsheet, all of it flowed through Microsoft's law. Windows 3.0 had cracked the door open, but its successor, Windows 95, would blow it off its hinges. Erecting the beast, the early 90s were in violent time inside Microsoft. The company's success had made it both rich and paranoid. Gates pushed harder than ever. He could smell the coming big thing, the network world, and wanted to ensure Microsoft stayed ahead of it. He gathered his top masterminds and made it clear Windows 95 had to be perfect. It wasn't just another product. It was a statement, evidence that Microsoft could dominate both technology and culture. For two times, thousands of inventors worked day and night. Gates reviewed progress daily, frequently asking the kind of brutal questions that left indeed elderly masterminds sweating. He'd gawk at a screen of law and still ask, "Why does it do that?" If you didn't have a precise answer, you were done. But beneath the pressure, there was purpose. Gates wasn't trying to cheapen anyone. He was obsessed with excellence. His brain sounded wired to see inefficiency as an adversary, commodity to be hunted and corrected. And sluggishly, the pieces came together. The launch that shook the world on August 24, 1995, Microsoft launched Windows 95. It was further than software. It was an artistic event. The marketing was unknown. $300 million spent worldwide, with the Rolling Monuments, Start Me Up, blasting in television advertisements. The launch button had come a symbol of a new period. At night, lines formed outside computer stores like it was a musicale. People cheered as the boxes arrived. Journalists called it the dawn of the information age. Within days, Windows 95 vended over 7 million clones. Businesses upgraded overnight. Homes that had no way possessed a PC now wanted one. Gates appeared on talk shows, smiling in his blue sweater, explaining how this technology would connect the world. For a brief moment, he wasn't just a businessman. He was an artistic icon. The empire expands with Windows 95 as its backbone. Microsoft launched a surge of products. Office came the gold standard for productivity. Internet Discover was introduced to contend with Netscape in the cyber surfer wars. Windows NT laid the foundation for business waiters. DirectX opened the door for PC gaming. Every part of the digital ecosystem sounded to run through Redmond. By 1998, Microsoft's periodic profit had surpassed $15 billion. Gates' particular fortune made him the richest man on Earth. His wealth grew so fast that magazines began tracking it like a sport. But then's what intriguing. The plutocrat no way sounded account important to him. Gates wasn't flashy. No private spurts covered in gold. No yachts lined with marble. He still drove himself to work. He still learned license plate figures of workers who stayed late, just to know who was really devoted. What drove him wasn't wealth, it was control. He wanted to be the mastermind of the digital world. The internet wars, and that world was changing faster than anyone anticipated. In 1993, a small company called Netscape had launched a cyber surfer that made the internet accessible to ordinary people. Suddenly, Information was then trapped on droopy disks or original drives. It was far and wide. At first, Microsoft undervalued it. Gates admitted latterly that he'd been slow to grasp how transformative the web would be. But once he understood, he replied with his trademark intensity. In 1995, he wrote a now notorious memo named The Internet Tidal Wave. In it, he advised that the web would change everything and that Microsoft demanded to act incontinently or be left before. He reorganized the entire company overnight. Thousands of workers shifted focus. Every Microsoft product would now connect to or work the Internet. The centerpiece of that strategy was Internet Explorer, Microsoft's own cyber surfer, whisked directly into Windows 95. It was smart, aggressive, and controversial. Netscape could then contend with free. Within a many times, Internet Discover had crushed its rival. But that move, integrating the cyber surfer with the operating system, would come back to hang Gates in ways he didn't yet realize. The antitrust storm by 1997, the U.S. government began to take notice. Controllers indicted Microsoft of using its dominance unfairly, specifically of forcing PC manufacturers to include Internet Explorer, making it nearly insolvable for challengers like Netscape to survive. The case exploded into a full-bloated antitrust trial. For the first time, Bill Gates, the private, precise, regular genius, was thrust into a public courtroom drama. The world watched as he defended the company he'd erected. His deposit videotapes came ignominious. Attorneys grilled him about monopolies, competition, and intent. Gates, visibly bothered, answered in cropped, protective tones. He wasn't used to being challenged outside his own sphere. In Microsoft halls, his word was law. In court, it wasn't. The media painted him as ruthless, a brilliant dictator who wanted to enjoy the digital world. Gates abominated that image. He believed deeply that Microsoft had earned its dominance by erecting better products, not by cheating. But the trial was brutal. In 2000, a judge ruled that Microsoft had indeed violated antitrust laws. The original decision indeed proposed breaking the company in two, one for Windows, one for everything differently. Though that bifurcation was latterly capsized on appeal, the blow was significant. Gates' conglomerate had been shaken. Behind the pressure through it all, Gates kept his countenance, at least intimately. But those close to him noticed a shift. The grim energy that had formerly been purely creative was now protective. He was no longer just erecting effects, he was guarding them. Inside Microsoft, morale dipped. Masterminds stressed layoffs. Directors argued over strategy. Gates set up himself torn between his passion for software and the growing demands of managing a massive scan pot. He began to withdraw from the day-to-day grind, fastening more on long-term vision. By the late 1990s, Steve Ballmer, his longtime friend and Harvard chum, had taken over much of the business leadership. Gates remained a visionary, but he was no longer the center of every decision. That transition was uneasy. Control had been his lifeblood. But part of Gates' genius was knowing when to evolve. Indeed, if it meant stepping back. The shift in perspective, the antitrust fire, forced Gates to reflect on further than just business. It made him question what he wanted his heritage to be. Did he want to be flashed back as the richest man in history, or as someone who actually changed the world for the better? Around this time, his humanitarian side began to crop more easily. In 1994, he married Melinda French. The two participated in a deep sense of responsibility toward global issues, health, poverty, education. They talk about inequality, about the power of wisdom to break problems, about using data to make the world fairer. In 1997, they created the William H. Gates Foundation, which latterly intermingled into Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Gates had spent his life erecting systems. Now he wanted to make one that could attack humanity's toughest challenges. From law to conscience by the end of the 1990s, the world was changing faster than ever. The Internet had gone mainstream. Google was born. Apple was recovering under Steve Jobs. The Fleck.com smash was rewriting the rules of business. Microsoft was still important, but no longer the scrappy inventor. It was the establishment, the giant everyone wanted to beat. Gates felt the shift. He was sent to sacrifice presently. He was a conglomerate. and like all conglomerates, is at adversaries, critics, and cracks. But rather retreating, he began to suppose long term. However, perhaps it could do it again, only this time, not through operating systems. If technology could transfigure the world formally, the seeds of his alternate act, the philanthropist, the leftist, the big picture thinker, were formally sprouting. Heritage of the 90s looking back. The 1990s were both Gates' triumph and his trial. He'd conquered the software world, reshaped global business, and made particular calculating a menage reality. But he'd also learned the limits of power, that brilliance and ambition alone say and shield you from public counterreaction or moral responsibility. What made Gates different from so numerous others was not just intelligence, it was rigidity. He could pivot, learn, and rewire his thinking when reality demanded it. That skill would define the coming phase of his life, the part where he'd trade request domination for global impact. But that's ahead. For now, at the close of the Renaissance, Bill Gates stood at the crossroads of two worlds, one he'd erected with his own hands, and another he was just beginning to imagine. The time 2000 was just the launch of a new Renaissance. For Bill Gates, it marked the end of one life and the morning of another. For nearly three decades, he'd lived at full cock, writing law, negotiating deals, fighting suits, and pushing the mortal race into the digital age. But now, the world he helped produce was changing faster than indeed he could prognosticate. The Fleck calm bubble was inflating to the point of asininity. Tech millionaires were being formed overnight. Microsoft, once the rebellious era Vista, had come to commercial Goliath everyone either depended on or despised. And at the top of that mountain, Gates began to realize commodity he didn't want to be there ever. Stepping back in January 2000, Gates blazoned that he was stepping down as CEO of Microsoft. The job would go to Steve Ballmer, his longtime friend and assistant, while Gates would remain as chairman and chief software architect. To the outside world, it looked like a shift in title. But outside, it was much more. For the first time, Gates was designedly pulling himself out of the day-to-day grind that had defined his actuality since he was 20. He didn't step down out of prostration. He stepped down because he understood influence. He knew that his impact no longer depended on tete-a-tete running the company. Microsoft was a tone-sustaining machine now, with thousands of brilliant masterminds and billions in cash inflow. His energy could be spent away on effects that signified beyond the balance distance. Still, it wasn't easy. Control had been his oxygen. Letting go meant reconsidering who he was, the world's utmost notorious workaholic, to understand what this transition meant. You have to grasp how Gates allowed about time. He'd formally said, half-joking, "I no way took a day off in my 20s. Not one." It was true. Indeed, when Microsoft came enormous, Gates tete-a-tete reviewed law, grilled design leads, and transferred late-night emails full of questions. His recesses generally lasted 48 hours before he'd get restless. He measured life and affair. Results. Enhancement. Effectiveness. But in his early 40s, commodities shifted. The antitrust trial had lowered him. Marriage and motherhood predicated him. And the sheer scale of his wealth, knockouts of billions by also, forced a new kind of question, what do I do with all this? He started studying global issues with the same intensity he formally applied to software. Contagious conditions. Education inequity. Poverty traps. Melinda, inversely sharp and compassionate, push those exchanges deeper. Together, they realize that their plutocrat could do commodity no government bureaucracy or charity can move presto, measure results, and scale ideas. This was a new kind of systems allowing not about computers, but about humanity. The birth of the Gates Foundation in 2000, they officially launched the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, incorporating two lower family charities into one concentrated, data-driven hustler. Its charge was bold but clear: reduce global inequality through health, education, and access to technology. They started with vaccines. The sense was straightforward. Complaint was one of the most soluble causes of poverty. However, parents could plan, husbandry could grow, if children did and die youthful. So Gates began pouring billions into hookups with associations like WHO, UNICEF, and Gavi. The foundation helped fund immunization programs that reached hundreds of millions of children in the developing world. behind the humanitarian tone, Gates' mastermind's brain was still at work. He demanded measurable issues, maps, criteria, feedback circles. To him, charity without data was just saccharinity. He wasn't trying to be a saint. He was trying to break problems. Balancing two worlds indeed after stepping down as CEO, Gates didn't evaporate from Microsoft. He was still its intellectual anchor. The early 2000s brought new challenges, the rise of Google, the explosion of the internet, and the dawn of the smartphone period. Gates kept pushing the company to acclimatize. He led development on Windows XP, helped launch Xbox, and oversaw exploration into everything from artificial intelligence to tablet computing. But sluggishly, his attention began to cock down from the fences and toward wisdom. He'd meet with epidemiologists rather of masterminds. His briefings were about malaria rather request share. The language changed, but the intensity did end. And then's what's remarkable. Gates no way saw this as a departure from technology. To him, public health and software were and contraries. They were both systems problems. You diagnose the tailback, make tools, and gauge the result. It was the same mind, just a broader battleground. The public's mixed view as Gates reinvented himself. Public opinion followed a strange wind. In the 1990s, he'd been portrayed as the ruthless monopolist, brilliant but cold, a man who crushed competition through intellect and power. By the 2000s, that image softened. The billionaire who formerly ruled tech was now giving it down to fight malaria and reform education. Still, not everyone bought the metamorphosis. Some critics argued that his philanthropy was another form of control, that he was reshaping global health policy without responsibility. Others indicted the foundation of pushing Western precedences onto developing nations. Gates didn't argue intimately. He knew influence always came with dubitation. His focus remained on prosecution, results over rhetoric. In interviews, he'd smile noiselessly and say, "Judge us by issues." And the issues were stunning. Polio cases dropped by over 99. Malaria deaths declined. HIV treatments reached millions further people. The same drive that formerly erected Microsoft conglomerate was now being used to save lives. Life at the top, life at home behind the scenes. Gates' particular life was evolving too. He and Melinda had three children and tried to raise them with some sense of normality. No lavish birthrights, no unbounded honor. The kiddies went to public seminaries. Gates still did the dishes at night. But the balance between public duty and private life was hard to maintain. Gates was still consumed by work. Only now it was philanthropy rather software. Melinda, who had her own strong sense of independence, occasionally upset that their lives were tipping too far toward the charge and down from a marriage. But for numerous times, they made it work. Their cooperation, professional in particular, remained the machine behind the foundation's growth. They traveled constantly to Africa, India, Latin America, meeting health workers, scholars, and growers. Gates, who formerly watched only about bits and law, was learning how people live without access to indeed introductory musts. It was humbling. He latterly admitted those gestures change him further than any business palm ever had. Technology marches on meanwhile. The tech world kept evolving, occasionally briskly than Microsoft could keep up. Apple, revived under Steve Jobs, released the iPod, also the iPhone. Google came the new doorkeeper of the internet. Social media began reshaping communication itself. Microsoft, despite its wealth and dominance, plotted to introduce at the same speed. Gates' conservative, system-driven culture had formerly been an advantage. Now it was decelerating the company down. In 2006, Gates made another big decision. He transitioned out of his diurnal part at Microsoft entirely. He'd remain president but shift nearly all his time to the foundation. That moment, quiet, thoughtful, and deeply particular, was a true turning point. The man who formerly wanted every computer to run his software now wanted every child to have a chance to live. Heritage and stir by the mid-2000s. Bill Gates had come commodity more complex than a businessman. He was a ground between the digital age he created and the philanthropic age he hoped to inspire. His vision extended beyond technology, cleanser energy, better education, smarter husbandry. He saw invention as the only sustainable answer to poverty and climate change. And though he had critics, many could deny the sheer scale of what he was trying. The foundation's talent exceeded $50 billion. Its reach gauged mainlands. Gates frequently said, "The measure of progress isn't what you construct for the rich, but what you do for the poor." That line added up how far he'd come. From a teenager chasing lines of law to a man chasing results to global suffering. Reflection looking back on a career in 2008. Gates gave a quiet, nearly nostalgic speech to Microsoft workers as he formally stepped down from his full-time part. He thanked them for believing that software could change the world, also broke, visibly emotional, and said, "It did." Also, he smiled, half backward, partial proud, and added, "Now I've got another problem set to work on." It was a veritably Bill Gates way of saying goodbye. He didn't see life in chapters, just in challenges. Each bone needed sense, creativity, and continuity. Microsoft had been the first. Humanity itself was the coming. Ending the loop, the world knew him as the richest man alive. But if you ask Gates how he wanted to be flashback, he'd presumably say as a problem solver. His entire gospel, from knowledge curiosity to conglomerate structure to philanthropy, was erected on that foundation. Find a system. Understand its sense. Make it better. That's the thread connecting the Lakeside school hacker, the Microsoft visionary, and the global health leftist. It's not about wealth or fame. It's about the preoccupation with enhancement. The belief that knowledge, duly applied, can fix nearly anything. And that's what made the turn of the Renaissance such an important pivot point. Bill Gates didn't quit. He just changed what he was optimizing for.